Blood Quine Online, your grocery neighborhood podcast host, play by play, and color analyst for life, along with Sex and the Pews choir director and Glow Enterprises rock star
Owen Rivers.
On a beautiful day in Tampa Bay, you've got two for Tuesday, Glenn and Owen, for Tuesday, June 25th, 2019.
The only
6/25/2019
in the history of humanity.
Big O, let us continue to choose.
On purpose.
With a purpose.
To give.
A great Tuesday.
Great Tuesday.
How are you?
Amazing. How are you?
I have no complaints, but thank you for caring enough to ask.
That's why they pay me the big bucks to ask these questions.
I have a lot of questions.
Ask away, my friend.
Well, we're going to bring our special guest on for the questions.
Okay. All right. I see.
He is
a little radio tease there.
He's an old friend. He is a rock star in his own right, and he's my favorite author. So without any further ado, please welcome online. You know him, you love him. We would not want to live without him. Rich Cohen. Rich!
Hey, how are you, Glenn?
Rich, again, I have no complaints, but I know you're a caring person, and I thank you for caring enough to ask. So
no problem.
Rich Cohen is a great author. He's my favorite author. How soon, Rich, in your writing career did you realize this was something you were great at?
I don't think you ever realize you're great at it, but I knew that I wanted to do it probably from the time I was a little kid. I mean, I was always interested in telling stories in one way or another. And then basically my father tried to make me go to law school. So I thought being a writer was my only way out of that.
Explain to the beautiful humans who your father is.
He's a kid from Brooklyn who's like basically took the rules of being a street corner wise guy and turned him into a whole business about negotiating. And when I was a kid, he wrote a book called You Can Negotiate Anything that was New York Times best. He wrote it in our basement on yellow legal pads with calligraphy pen. And it got rejected by like 22 publishers. And then some little publisher took it on and basically was on the New York Times bestsellers list for like a couple of years.
Wow.
And the only reason why it wasn't number one is because it was published at the same time as Cosmos by Carl Sagan, like
wow,
the best-selling book in history, causing him to curse Carl Sagan his entire life.
Herb Cohn is Rich's dad's name, and he worked in the Carter and Reagan administrations. What does your dad think of the current occupant of the White House?
If you bring up Trump, he just sort of chuckles and says Trump is crazy. That's all he'll say. He tries to avoid politics.
Interesting for a guy that was involved in politics. And Rich's dad, Herb, coined the phrase, it's a win-win.
That's right. And actually, Trump blurbed my father's second book. When Trump was running for election, my father used to always say that Trump was going to make him, if he got elected, when it seemed impossible, that Trump was going to make him the ambassador to Barbados. But it hasn't happened.
How old is Herbie?
He's like, keep saying that crap, and you can't visit me when I'm in the ambassador of Barbados. He's 86.
He's 86.
Unbelievable.
And
yeah.
He and I are friends on the Facebook, you know. And
yeah, he's not great at Facebook. As you might have noticed, every now and then it says that, you know, there's an update. Herb Cohen's updated his profile, and it's a picture of his ankle and his leg because he's hit the picture button while reading Facebook, and I'm just scared about the day he's on the toilet and does it. Hasn't happened yet.
that's good. Although that would be some interesting posting right there. But I'm always it always humors me at the posts that your dad likes of mine. They're just completely obscure, and I never can figure it out. But I always appreciate it, of course.
Yeah, and you can't really. He's unpredictable.
And then
I
sent you a picture of a Chinese restaurant named Win Win. Did you see that?
So funny.
And I was wondering.
No, I didn't see it.
I was wondering if Herb got his taste from the Chinese restaurant, so to speak.
I'm sure. We used to do a whole bit about the Chinese restaurant, that he loved to eat at the Chinese restaurant, because the Chinese restaurant was an example of the how over the what, that basically society was making him feel bad for having so many kids. But he went to a Chinese restaurant. They said having five in the family qualified you to order from the special columns in the back. So it made him feel very good. Didn't feel he was destroying the environment.
Rich's dad was known as the world's greatest negotiator.
It's quite a title.
That's right. Well, he was on the START talks. He was involved in negotiating with the Russians over nuclear weapons. And probably the best chapter of his book was called The Soviet Style, just about the way the Russians negotiated. This is like in the 80s. And my favorite thing in his book is, because he's just talking about different leaders, and he talks about somebody we both probably remember, the Mayor Daley, the original Mayor Daley. And when Mayor Daley had died, and I guess the mayor then at the time was Jane Byrne.
Right.
And he was at O'Hare Airport, and the flight was delayed, and it was snowing. And what was amazing about that is it was like snowing in October. And the guy in the seat next to him turned to him and said, you know, it never snowed this early when Daley was mayor.
Of course, Mayor Daley famously stole the election for John Kennedy. A lot of dead people voted in Chicago that particular election day in 1960. Do you remember the song by the great late Steve Goodman about Mayor Daley?
Yeah, I remember he has that line. He loved McCormick Place so much he built it twice. I think that was the line.
Richard J. Daley was the mayor of our town until that cold day in December when they laid him in the ground. Daley's gone. One more. He was one of the great corrupt city machines in all, of all time. I mean, his impact on that city is still being felt all these decades later.
I remember the story that my father used to tell about Daley. I forget which one of Daley's kids was trying to get his real estate license, and you had to get at least a 65% to get the license, and he kept getting like 62%. He failed it like three times, and finally Daley just changed the law to make it you only had to get a 60, and it went into power retroactively.
Wow.
Rich is a native Chicagoan calling us where on this fine day?
In Maine, on Penobscot Bay.
Wow. Now he's a rich, he's Richie Rich, if you will.
Now, we're way up there in Maine. If you're willing to drive, almost like up in the Arctic, if you're willing to drive very far, you can get good deals in Maine. Just telling your people out there.
Remember that remember that Sopranos episode when Tony goes up to Bobby Bacalera's house in Maine?
Yeah. And that's where he finds a guy in witness protection.
Right.
Is that the one?
No. This is where they beat the shit out of each other. They're playing Monopoly.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's horrible. Yeah.
And then Tony makes his brother-in-law go and kill that guy in Canada.
Yeah.
Good times.
I'm thinking of the one where he takes Meadow on a college visit and he runs into a guy from witness protection.
Right.
And that's at Colby, I think, which is in Maine.
Yeah, that's right. Your family, starting with your dad, and obviously you have a pretty keen interest in the underworld, if you will, and it has a lot to do with your latest book, which we're going to talk a lot about. How do you think that came about?
Well, I think my father grew up in a neighborhood in where there were like a lot of guys, got a lot of gangsters lived. You know, it's where like Sammy the Bull was from, and all the guys in the Gotti's crime family were from. And my father grew up at a time, you know, when he used to joke about his neighborhood. When you asked what the ethnic makeup of his neighborhood was, he'd say it's 48% Jewish, 48% Italian, 2% other, or 49%. So, and a lot of there's been this big Jewish mob from Brownsville, Brooklyn. And a lot of them live there. And these are guys like Louis Lepke, Buck Alter, and Abe Kid Twistrellis, and Bugsy Goldstein, and Happy Levine, and TikTok Tannenbaum. And they were Murder Incorporated. They were half of Murder Incorporated. And he grew up surrounded by those guys with those stories. A lot of them died in the electric chair during the Second World War when my father was a kid, and when he was about 10 years old. And then we moved to, not to Chicago, but to the suburbs. And I think he had this idea that you only got one sense of a certain kind of Jewish life and a certain kind of life altogether. And he wanted me to have a sense of the variety. You know, it's like part of knowing Jewish athletes. You know, it's like knowing that there's all different kinds of destinies open to you, good and bad, regardless of your background. So he would tell me these stories when I was going to sleep about Jewish gangsters. And those are the stories that I heard instead of your regular bedtime stories. So I just became obsessed with those stories. And then he was very into all the mob movies, the old ones like The Roaring Twenties and Angels with Dirty Faces. And of course, The Godfather was like the Bible And he used to say, sit down, you know, and learn a little something about life. And then one of the worst moments of my life is he said, your brother is like Sonny Corleone. He's a good son, but not a good leader. And I said, which one am I like? And he's thinking he'd say, as like Michael, he said, you're like Fredo. You have a good heart.
I'm smart.
So anyway,
I want respect. Yeah. I'm smart.
I can do things. So it just, so when I came to New York, you know, I moved to New York after college and I started, I wanted to go to those places that he talked about and see if his stories were true. And I started doing a lot of reporting and met a lot of the remnants of that. And that was my first book, which was Tough Jews, which was about that gang and what happened to them and why guys like my father continued to tell the stories.
You know that my family was connected in Chicago. Did I ever tell you that?
No.
Yeah, my uncle, well, my grandfather, Harold Sachs, was a bootlegger. And then when Prohibition was repealed, he continued selling, but, you know, shit flows downhill, and it continued to. Is that the saying, shit flows downhill or uphill?
I try not to think too much about shit, but I'm sure it's
that's their saying.
Somewhere.
It was the mob still controlled it. So he, but his brother Mike continued to be a bag man, and his son Al Sachs went out to Vegas in the 1950s and started dealing blackjack. And by the time I was a kid, he owned the Stardust, the Fremont, and the Sundance.
That's amazing.
And then he came into the Stardust right after what the movie Casino was all about, which that happened in the Stardust. That was him. And then eventually he lost his gaming license in Nevada due to ties. They were still skimming off the top. But it was a unique upbringing between going to Camp Menominee in the summer and Vegas for Christmas break. It was interesting. It was a good time. Yeah, so you mentioned that your first book was Tough Jews and the Avengers.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, it was fun. It was different for sure. And we were having lunch in the coffee shop at the Stardust one time. My grandfather, my uncle Kenny, and Al Sachs, who owned the joint, and I was, I think, probably 13 at the time. And I looked at my uncle Al and I said, "Al, does the mafia have anything to do with this place?"
Right.
And they changed the topic quickly. And my uncle Kenny came up to me after lunch and said, "Never, ever use that word again." I was like, "Okay, no problem." So, yeah, so Tough Jews, the first one. This latest book is about the last pirate ship of New York, a ghost ship, or the last pirate ship of New York, a ghost ship of a killer, and the birth of a gangster nation. It's a story about Albert Hicks. Who is Albert Hicks?
Right. Well, to go back a little, because these things are, well, these stories are connected because you're talking about Vegas and talking about Prohibition and everything. Well, basically, in like earlier era, before like the 1920s, before the First World War, there had been these in New York, specifically I'm talking about, there hadn't been the mob or the mafia. There had been these huge street gangs, almost like out of the movie The Warriors is like the closest depiction of it, where it was huge. Usually, you know, there's Irish gangs, German gangs. Later on, there were Jewish
hey Rich,
born in America, Anglo-Saxon, other gangs like.
Hey Rich, are you have you been walking away from where your Wi-Fi is up there in Maine? Because it's really breaking.
How's
up.
How's that?
It was great before, and now it's been breaking up a little bit.
Okay.
All right, so we're good. All right.
All right. So can you hear me now?
Yeah, it's good.
All right. So they I don't know how if you lost anything I said, but there are these huge ethnic gangs, and they would basically work for politicians doing the stuff we're talking about daily, getting them to do, which is getting out the vote. And Arnold Rothstein, who I read a lot about in Tough Jews, was this kind of rich kid who hung around downtown because he liked to gamble and became friends with all these young Italian and Jewish gangsters. And he sort of said, you know, you should reorganize this whole thing and you shouldn't be working for the politicians. The politicians should be working for you. And he had the whole idea that became the five families. And he said, you should run it like it's the Ford Motor Company or U.S. Steel. And he set up this whole system, and they fought a gang war to establish it. And then when Prohibition came along, what happened is they now had a huge, what had been a legitimate business, and all this money flowed into it, and the modern mob came out of it. But like I said before that, were there these big ethnic armies, and if you go all the way back to the Civil War, that's like what Scorsese had in the Gangs in New York, which from this great book, Gangs in New York, you have downtown in New York, the worst slum in the world called the Five Points, which was like an entirely condemned neighborhood. full of incredibly poor people. The police afraid to even go in there, and everybody protected by these gangs. And in the middle of it is a guy I wrote about who I was interested in because he was like the first gangster who became a big famous pop star in New York. He was the last man publicly executed in New York. 20,000 people watched him be hung, and he operated so long ago that they didn't even call him a gangster. They called him a pirate. And he would work between the slums and mutinying on ships. And my book is really just about the last 3 months of his life when he went on this, in typical gangster fashion, one more crime spree because he'd just been married to set himself up for the rest of his life. And, of course, that's the one that he got caught. And what he'd done is he'd signed onto a ship that he knew had a lot of money. He waited till the ship got away from the, the New York port, South Street Seaport, out into the sea. And he killed everybody on the ship. And his idea was to take all the money from the ship, sail the ship up the Hudson River, sink it, and then go home. He lived on Cedar Street, but another ship in the middle of the night crashed into his ship, making it so he couldn't sail it. So he attempted to sink it, but he did it in a big hurry because he knew the police were coming. He took all the money he could, and he took off, resulting in this huge manhunt, which completely dominated the press in the entire country. In the summer of 1860, which is the summer before the Civil War, and he became this huge celebrity all over the world. And when they asked him who he was, he said, "You know who I am. I'm the worst man who ever lived." And he said he'd made this pact with the devil, and he'd spent 20 years. They said he killed over 100 people, he confessed to killing.
Wow.
And if you go back and hear old gangster stories, the oldest guys who are telling stories about this guy. Because this guy was like the guy who didn't have to belong to a gang because people belong to a gang for protection. He was the guy you needed to be protected from, you know, and he was killed on Friday, July 13th, 1860. Some people say that's where July 13th got its sort of bad name. And it was just this huge drunken party when he was hung in New York Harbor, which is why they got rid of public executions after him. Because they meant it to be this somber event that would scare people into straight lives, and instead it just became a big drunken Mardi Gras parade.
Jeez. What a rock star.
Yeah. I mean, even like I wrote a story for the New York Times basically arguing that he's the one who created all the gangster style. So when you would see a guy like John Gotti sitting in front of the Ravenite Club on Mulberry Street in Manhattan, which you'd sometimes see, wearing, you know, a pink suit with yellow socks. You know, and like you were kind of seeing a guy imitating a guy, imitating a guy, imitating Albert Hicks. And Albert, one of the things he really described about Albert Hicks was a special suit he had made for his execution, which was an electric blue suit with anchors stitched into the sleeves and gold buttons. I mean, can you imagine a pirate being hung in New York in an electric blue suit with anchors on the sleeves and golden buttons? Completely crazy.
If you're going to go out, you might as well go out in style.
Right.
But sure. the thing that got me so interested in this story for years and years and years and years, if, you know, New York has this very contained harbor, which is why it is New York. Okay, so people woke up one morning and in the middle of this harbor, there's just a ship just floating around, and which was terrifying to people. And it's an image I couldn't get out of my head. And they called it a ghost ship. And they sent out the harbor patrol, go on the boat. The boat was entirely empty, except they said the decks of the ship looked like it had been washed in blood. They could find nothing else on it. They towed it into South Street Seaport, and they sent detectives aboard to search it, and they could find nothing. And finally, one found 4 severed fingers and a thumb. And that was all the evidence they found, and that was really the beginning of the story.
How did you decide to write this story?
Well, when I was working on Tough Jews, I went back to read all about, like when I was writing about the Cubs, I went back and read about the whole history of Major League Baseball. I just like to know how things started. You know, I was writing about the Bears. I read about the whole history of the NFL. It became part of the story. In this case, I wanted to read the history of the mob in New York. I mean, like a guy like Dutch Schultz, who was a Jewish gangster. His name wasn't really Dutch Schultz. It was Arthur Flegenheimer. But he'd been named after an earlier gangster who was German named Dutch Schultz. And he'd been particularly ferocious in a way that reminded people of this other guy. That's where the name came from. So you go back and you keep going back. And ultimately, you go back to the beginning. In the beginning, you'd always read stories about this guy, Albert Hicks, because he'd been really famous. He'd been on the front page of the newspapers for like, you know, 6 months. And people, even into the 1920s, he was a household name. So I wanted to find out about him. And the more I found out, the more I found out, one, people had his story wrong. Two, one of the reasons he was famous is he was absolutely charismatic like a movie star and incredibly violent. And three, he was the basis for so many of the ways we look about gangsters. And he just became to me almost like a founding father of this other country, which was the gangster country, the gangster republic.
Or as you said, the birth of a gangster nation.
Yeah, he was like, I said, we like if you're living, I've lived in New York or in the New, around New York for the last, whatever it is, 30 years or 20 years. And it's like, you know, the founders of New York, they're Peter Stuyvesant, you know, and, you know, the people who the famous leaders is Fiorello LaGuardia. And but this guy is just as important and just as much of a founder. It's just to the lower world instead of the upper. And I always had heard that Meyer Lansky famously was the guy who took craps, which had been, you know, a dice game people played on the street, and put it on a table in a room. And my father used to say, but never forget, that's still the same game. It just played up on a different level is all. And same way with this, it's still, he was still playing the same game in some way, just played on a different level, much lower level.
Remember the scene in Godfather 2 where Michael is having his meeting with the senator, Cleary from Nevada, and Michael says to the senator, "Senator, we're both part of the same hypocrisy."
And exactly.
How accurate do you think that that statement is?
It's very accurate, because if, like, the guy who was the federal marshal who actually hung Albert Hicks, like, he was responsible for the actual hanging. His name was Isaiah Rinders. Okay, Isaiah Rinders was a guy who on the Mississippi River. He was a card sharp. He was in knife fights. He came back to New York. He owned all these bars, and then he wound up running the Dead Rabbits, and he'd get the vote out. You know, so when you want, he brought out what they called the repeaters, the people who voted early and often, and he supposedly secured the election for several presidents, but famously he secured the election for James Buchanan, and James Buchanan named him the federal marshal. So basically James Buchanan was elected by the Dead Rabbits. So for then James Buchanan to turn around and say, I'm, you know, clean and these people are dirty, that's a joke. They're both part of the same hypocrisy.
Right.
And that's exactly what he was talking about up until, you know, Louis Slepke, who I mentioned, who was the only gang boss to ever die in the electric chair. He surrendered. He was wanted by in both New York State by Tom Dewey and by the federal government. And he surrendered to the federal government because he didn't believe they would ever turn him over to New York State. No, he surrendered to the state government. They believed the federal government never turned him over to New York State because he had gotten the vote out for Franklin Roosevelt through the unions. And he thought, if they ever like put me in the electric chair, I'm going to tell everything I know about how Franklin Roosevelt got elected and who voted for him. And it was just, you know, 50 years later, but it was the same system, which continues up to John Kennedy and Mayor Daley. It's all the same. So for that's what drove the mob so crazy about Robert Kennedy going after the mob,
right?
Because the mob got him elected. And also, his father, Joseph Kennedy, was a bootlegger and was in, you call him a mobster, call him whatever you want, but he was a bootlegger who was in partnership with Meyer Lansky and all these guys, either warring with them or partnering with them. And they felt that they had ultimately fought a gang war with him and had beaten him, and that Robert Kennedy was getting revenge for the father.
Did you see the documentary that HBO did on Sinatra?
I did.
Yeah, and they make a pretty, they do some pretty good connectivity between the mob being pretty pissed off that Kennedy or Robert Kennedy pressed in on prosecution when they thought that they had a deal with their dad, with Joe Kennedy.
Right, but it's always one of those things you wonder, like, did the kid even know? You know what I mean? You know, like, your father has this, like, what did Robert Kennedy know about what Joe Kennedy did? I don't know.
Yeah, but
I don't know if
that's one thing. But I mean, Sam Giancana and John Kennedy shared the same girlfriend, Judith Campbell. And then, I mean, do you think, I mean, obviously we have no public proof that there was a conspiracy, that the mob was involved in JFK's assassination, but that they really did a nice job on Sinatra's documentary of putting those pieces together. It's certainly plausible.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. That's a bit like anytime you go there, you end up. It leads you down. It leads you down such a wormhole, and it's such crazy stuff that you can easily start believing anything. I don't know what happened. I mean, I assume that, you know, it's like even paranoid people can have enemies. It's like Lee Harvey Oswald really could have just been psycho.
Yeah, no, I probably was.
Who was drifting? You know.
Yeah.
If you read about him, he went to Russia. He went to New Orleans. I mean, there's all kinds of things you can look at. But I do know that, you know, there were all these, that the Robert Kennedy connection with his father and the mob, all that's real. But see, I think a lot of that went on with previous presidents too, is my point. We just didn't know about it. I mean, like Harry Truman, who was two presidents before, he had the whole connection through Kansas City with all the political machine there that was really dirty,
right?
You know,
right.
And he ended up being a pretty clean guy, but he came out of a pretty dirty place. Eisenhower was different because he came through West Point in the military, completely different structure, but he was unusual. And I told you about FDR and Sidney Hillman and the unions and all that stuff. So I'm sure if you go and James Buchanan, it's a weird, it's hard to get elected president and you need a lot of help. And the people that help you aren't necessarily always the people with the best motives. Just put it that way.
Well, there's such a moral distinction, and people have such a preconceived notion about how terrible the mob is, and they are painted so negative. How much do you think that those motives really are? What makes those motives so negative? You know what I mean?
Well, I mean they're incredibly violent people who take a lot of money that. You know, if you're being muscled by them, they seem pretty evil, you know. And
what do you think?
New York.
How does a person get to that such, you know, detachment from normal social calibration?
I don't know. Bad parents? I mean, I think that.
They ate too much sugar cereal.
I think that they're, and to some extent, they grew up in the. It's like. You know, like you play in a sport and these are the rules of the sport and you don't really, unless you're a kind of a smart person who can be detached, you don't really necessarily stop to think, hey, what am I doing? You know what I mean? And so many of them were just kids on the street and these are what older kids were doing and they just got pulled in and they never really stepped back to think about it. And when the mob was very organized, it had very clear rules. It made it seem like everybody, you know, he chose this is the life we chose. Like he's choosing to play the game. It's like a player who gets concussed in football in 1980 complaining about it. It's like, you knew what you were doing and you knew what you were playing. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
it's also, they consider themselves soldiers. So obviously people die in war all the time. Soldiers kill other soldiers. Sometimes soldiers kill civilians and it's okay
because right.
You're a soldier and they just rationalize.
And and they had a system. So, like, you know, one of the things is Thomas Dewey, who was the governor of New York and ran against Truman and thought he'd beat Truman. That's the famous Dewey defeats Truman headline. He went after the mob for the first time after they become organized, which wasn't really very long. If you think about it, it was like it'd been going for like 20, 30 years when he really made a move to try to break them up. And he went after Dutch Schultz. And I don't know if you know this story, but Dutch Schultz went to the syndicate. It's like the group of guys that run the five families, run the mob. And he said he couldn't do anything without going to them and getting permission. And he said, and he was on that, one of the six. And he said, I want to kill Dutch Schultz. I want to kill Tom Dewey. And they said, okay, well, let's even see if it's possible. So they had these two gangsters go make like a study, like an intelligence report. Can you kill Tom Dewey? And Tom Dewey lived on the Upper East Side of New York. And his office was downtown, and he had bodyguards around him all the time. So they had a couple guys follow his entourage, and they discovered that every morning after he left his apartment, he stopped at a sort of pharmacy lunch counter near his apartment, and he would order a coffee, get the paper, and then while they were making his breakfast, he'd go into the back where there was a row of phone booths, call his office and just check in and see if there were any messages. And his bodyguards didn't go with him when he went to the back of the place. They said, if we have two guys in the phone booths in the back, he comes back alone, we can kill him in the phone booth, get out the back door, they won't even check for 20 minutes, you know? So they went back and they told the syndicate board this, and they said, okay, yes, it's possible, but we're not going to do it because you can't kill a federal prosecutor. It's not going to make your problems better. It's going to make your problems worse. And Dutch Schultz said, well, I'm going to kill him anyway. So they said, we have to basically kill Dutch Schultz before he kills Tom Dewey. And two guys, Mendy Weiss and Charlie the Bug Workman, went out to the Palace Chop House and killed Dutch Schultz and his entourage to save the life of Thomas Dewey. And that's because they had these strict rules about what you were and were not allowed to do. And all of that made it seem more normal. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, there's, you know, obviously the rules of war are different than normal everyday life here in the United States of America. We're talking with Rich Cohn. Right. He is the author of his latest bestseller, The Last Pirate Ship of New York, A Ghost Ship of a Killer, and The Birth of a Gangsta Nation, about Albert Hicks. You've written about the mob. You've written sports books about the Bears and the Chicago Cubs. By the way, my favorite book of all time is The Chicago Cubs, Story of a Curse. My favorite book of all time. I could read that over and over again. Dude, I was just on your Wikipedia page. And of all your books, including your latest books on there, The Story of a Curse, the curse continues. It's not listed on your Wikipedia page.
You know what? I don't do the Wikipedia page, so I didn't even know about that because, honestly, I don't know how to do the Wikipedia page. I don't want to know how.
Right, but I think it's disrespecting the Cubs again. Somebody is, anyway. And, of course, you were part of the Rolling Stones life for quite a while and wrote the book The Sun and the Moon of the Rolling Stones. If you had to say, if you had to pick one topic, whether it be sports, the mob, or rock and roll music, which would be the one that you say, okay, I can do this the rest of my life?
Well, see, I think it's all one topic, even though it might not seem that way. It's all about kind of outlaws, people who live by their own rules, charisma, being cool, and rock and roll. And that goes with all these people.
I could relate
Keith
to
Richards
that.
Is reading this. Keith Richards is reading this book right now, you know, because Keith Richards is a pirate in his own way. So I don't see it as, I see it as, to me, there's no real hard distinction between the topics. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I hear you. You see the meme that's got a picture, a modern day picture of Keith Richards and says, every time you smoke a cigarette, you add 5 minutes to Keith Richards' life.
Right. That's hilarious.
How is he doing, Keith Richards?
I think he's doing great. Who would think that Mick would go in for the heart surgery and Keith would just be, although to be fair, Keith has had brain surgery, so let's not forget that. But I think he's doing great. I like the one that says, let's think of the world we're all going to leave Keith Richards when we die. How does it go?
It's like that. Keith Richards. Yeah. They got one with Keith and Willie Nelson in there.
Met Willie Nelson actually even last year. That was like a great thing. I got to hang out with Willie Nelson.
Did you smoke weed with Willie on his bus?
I was on his bus, but he's now vaping weed mostly.
Uh-huh. So you didn't
get think he smokes it anymore.
Wasn't a lot of secondhand smoke going
on. No. I think he's just in a perpetually pickled state. I don't think he has to smoke anymore. I just think he is high.
So obviously you're in Maine. You're on family vacation. We hear the dog whimpering in the background there, your kids splashing around. What's going on?
Yeah, well, my wife just walked by walking her dog. And that was our dog. Our dog's an embarrassing. You know, you have your dog your whole life, and then you think your dog's great. And then you see your dog with other dogs, you realize my dog's kind of a big nerd, and I had no idea. That's kind of like our dog. She goes, when she sees other dogs, she starts to cry. And our kids are just going around on a paddleboard.
That sounds fun.
In the ocean, in the bay.
Speaking of summer, when are you going to write the ultimate book about the history of Camp Menominee?
I'm going to write it.
Are you?
I don't know when. Yeah.
Because it has all those ingredients. It has a charismatic founder, Nate Wasserman.
Yeah.
It has it's got all the ingredients.
Sex, drugs, and rock and roll, baby.
A lot of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. One of the camp owners delved into fundamentalist religion for a while, and then became a outspoken opponent of religion. You know who that is, right?
No.
Me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You don't know that?
No.
And then, of course, I got Rich was on the show monthly at the old radio station in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
Every month. Which, by the way, I'm really glad it was then versus now. I mean, I've been negotiating with you for 6 months to get on the show. What the fuck, dude? What happened? How did I become chopped liver all of a sudden?
You didn't become a chopped liver. It's because I became so. In the last year has been just been crazy year because my dad got sick, and then I had all this stuff to do. It's just been like, I haven't had a minute to. This is like the first time in about 6 months I've had to just sort of have an afternoon where I can talk.
I so appreciate it. I wanted Rich to be our first guest on the GKO, but he was a major member of the Power Rotation at the station.
Yeah, by the way, my favorite Camp Menominee story, a story I retell all the time, is your story you told me about adult camp and a 55-year-old getting homesick.
Yep.
You having to deal with that.
Yep.
I love that.
True story. And he ended up, I talked him into staying for the rest of the afternoon at our fantasy camp, which was just completed a few weeks ago, the 32nd annual fantasy camp. Now, you know, adult camping is a huge thing in this country. We were one of the first ones. So yeah, I was like, Tom, just hang out for the afternoon. You know, you got the softball. The guys need you. And he ended up getting the game winning hit, and the guys were pounding on him. He's like, I'll stay. It's just like camp. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, so, you just need to feel accepted. It's like the beginning of meatballs. Where you must be the short, depressed kid we ordered. Every camp. And you turn him around and make him feel part of the whole thing.
That's exactly right. And Nate,
that's my dog.
Yes,
that's what I'm talking about.
What's the dog's name? What's the dog's name?
Muddy. Muddy Waters.
Oh, nice.
Hey.
Nice.
Muddy.
Yeah.
Seen Muddy play.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah.
So Owen Rivers is a musician and a budding rock star. Based on your experience in the industry, reporting for Rolling Stone, hanging out with Mick and Keith and the Rolling Stones, what is the number one thing you would recommend for Owen to do or to not do going forward in his musical career?
How about not give a fuck?
Fuck yeah. Check.
That's,
I don't know.
That's pretty good.
Being a musician, it's kind of like being a writer. It's like you're absolutely in a way on your own.
Yeah.
And nobody really cares if you succeed. You got to do it all by yourself. It's basically the thing.
Carve your own path.
Yeah.
What do you think?
You got to just keep.
What mindset coming from your dad has been one that's paid the most dividends for you?
Well, my dad has this thing that he says. He says the secret to life is to care, but not that much. And I think that's it. He always said, if you play life like it's a game, you'll do well. Take it too seriously, you're screwed. So basically, it's kind of like a Jewish form of Buddhism, I think. And that's sort of how he lives. Like, he doesn't really care that much. And it's amazing how he doesn't. I mean, like I said, he's been sick a little bit. He's okay now. But if you ever ask him how he's doing, he goes, I'm doing great. Great. You know, so.
So how's that manifested for you?
I think that, you know, when you write stuff, especially like the stuff that I've written, which is have a tendency to rub some people the wrong way and piss them off, you attract a lot of people that attack you and enemies and stuff, and people say not nice things about you. And if you take it too seriously, you'll stop writing, you know, because no one likes getting called names. But I think if you just don't really care that much and realize really none of that really matters and you can't control it, then you can keep going. I'd say that's how it's manifested itself for me.
Do you know
what? And of course, some of that would be also come from being a Cubs fan.
why is that, Rocket Cohen? Richard Rocket Cohen?
Because you realize that there's a value to the games even when you're not going to win.
You know? I'm a huge hockey fan down here in Tampa, huge Lightning fan. And we tied the record. When I say we, it's because I've spent a lot of money and invested a lot of time and emotion. I consider myself part of the ownership group. the Lightning tied the all-time best regular season record with the Detroit Red Wings this past season, and we were odds-on favorite to win the Stanley Cup. And we got swept in the first round by the vaunted Columbus Blue Jackets.
I watched the whole thing very closely. First of all, I become a Rangers fan just by living in the – you know, because I can watch them on TV. And I always thought a Tampa Bay team is like the Rangers South because there's so many former Rangers
on
that team.
There are a lot of great Rangers, former Rangers on the Lightning. So it wasn't even close. I went to game three. I almost never leave a sporting event early. I left a Stanley Cup playoff game early. I couldn't take it. And I can't tell you what a gut punch it was to me to see the Lightning just not show up for four games, to get swept by the eighth seed, and then it was over, just like that. I mean, I've got the Cubs logo from when you and I were kids tattooed on my shoulder, and I was the Lightning crest was going to go underneath it after we won the Stanley Cup. And it was the worst. It was the worst sports fan experience I've ever had in my life.
But you know what though? It's a great lesson, I have to say.
All right, but let me finish, Rich.
As depressing as it is.
But let me finish this. The point. People know me. I'm a quasi public human being, and they know that I'm a Cubs fan. And people say, "Yeah, but you're a Chicago Cubs fan." I said, "But you don't understand. When you're a Cubs fan, that's what you expect to happen." When the Indians came and tied it up in Game 7 of the World Series, and it looked like they were going to win it just because the momentum was totally on Cleveland's side, it was just like, yep, this is how it goes. This is part of the deal. And then it started raining in Cleveland. But it wasn't expected with the Lightning. It was completely unexpected. When you're a Cub fan, Rich, this is part of the deal. Like you said, it informs your entire life philosophy.
Right. Well, also for the Cubs, you know, it's a great story, which is they were so bad and lost so dramatically. It's in such unbelievable ways that it became a kind of greatness, you know, a kind of an inverse negative flip side greatness.
Perverse greatness.
Right. So the fact that they would lose the World Series in the way that they lost it with whatever kind of giant lead they had in that Game 6 or Game 7, I forget what it was. It was like 13 to 2 or something. And they would lose was like horrible, but also, boy, this is really going to add to the legend, man. It's like we're towering it higher and higher and higher. Whereas Tampa Bay, if they lose like that, it's just the beginning of a horrible legend. I mean, but it is a – but
I feel better already.
I watched the whole thing. I mean, and they were a great team. I mean, but I do – my kid was playing mite hockey. He had this woman coach who said this thing to me that I always think of. She said there's nothing more dangerous in hockey than a 2-goal lead. And basically, 2 goals, you feel like you got it. It's over. Even if they score, we're still going to win. So you kind of stop playing, and then the other team suddenly is back in the game going 90 miles an hour, and it's very hard to turn it on again.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that's what happened to Tampa, which is they hadn't played in important, meaningful games in so long. And they were sort of coasting, and then they run to a team that had to fight its way into the playoffs, that is going full out, and they suddenly have to get rocking and rolling back to the way they were at the beginning of the year, and they can't. It's like they're flat-footed.
Here's another little-known fact by a lot of people, and again, a New York-Tampa connection. A few months before the season was over, John Tortorella, who was a Lightning coach, is the Columbus coach, hired Marty St. Louis, the Hall of Fame Lightning, who had played for John Cooper, the current coach, to come and coach at Columbus. And it was like he knew what they were going to do. And
go
ahead.
I don't know. I mean, that's what people said when the Tampa Bay coach, what's his name, Gruden came from Oakland. They played Oakland. I think it's actually probably more true in football when it's about the playbook and all that. But in hockey, basically, the guys have to go out and just beat each other. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Well, we're gonna see if I get revved up for the hockey season again. I could not watch any of the rest of the hockey. I couldn't watch it. I couldn't bring myself to watch it. I watched Game 7. I was happy to see the Bruins lose. That's for
well,
sure.
I liked that Boston. I was a big Tampa Bay. I was a big Toronto fan this year because I did a story about Zach Hyman, who plays on Toronto. I got to know him a little bit, but they lost to Boston, and I liked Bruins have a player that went to New Trier High School, my high school.
Who's that?
So, John Moore. He's a really tough defenseman.
New Trier comes up again. It's a very famous high school in Chicago.
But it's the first NHL player we've ever had.
Right. Do you know that I lost the gig at the Milwaukee radio station because I asked a question about hockey? Did you know that?
Really? No.
You know, we're supposed to be having a conversation about race in this country, Rich, right? And so I decided, since Milwaukee and Racine, where the station was located, are considered the worst cities in the country for African Americans, that I would do a segment every week on race, which I did. And a regular contributor was a local civil rights leader named Milt Thompson, and we developed a really nice rapport. Milt is a conservative guy. I'm libertarian, but we had a really nice give and take. And I came out of the news to talk about something that happened in the Lightning game the night before when Nikita Kucherov had scored a natural hat trick, three straight goals, very unusual. And I explained and defined for the audience and for Milt what a natural hat trick was, played the highlight over the radio, and it was, you know, it was a nice little shtick. And then I dovetailed back into my conversation on race with Milt, and I said to Milt, I said, you know, since Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier, basically African-Americans have dominated every team sport in baseball, basketball, and football. I said, why not hockey? Now, I know the reason, but I wanted him to answer the question. He answered it beautifully. He talked about the economic realities of hockey and then how it's starting to even out as the economics are starting to even out in the African-American community. And then we continued talking on whatever the hell we were talking about. I went on vacation that next day. When I came back from vacation, my boss called me into the conference room before I was about to go in the studio. And he said, did you ask Milt Thompson why blacks don't dominate in hockey? And I said, yes. He said, well, we had a complaint from a local civil rights group, and we can't have you on the radio anymore because of it.
Huh.
Yeah. And I was, and I said to him, I said, Dave, did you hear the clip? He said, nope. I said, do you want to hear the clip? He said, nope, the decision's been made. And that's how my career ended in Milwaukee. yeah. But
it sucks.
No, it really did suck. Because the whole reason I was in southern Wisconsin instead of here in Tampa Bay was because do this radio show.
Right.
And so, yeah, that was a gut punch, too. Not as bad as when the Lightning lost the Columbus, though, in four straight.
No, and remember, hockey's messed up a lot of our lives. You could just think about it that way.
No, it was. It's all worked out good. I never would have met Owen Rivers, never would have had the podcast start again, and our Sex in the Pew show, which is definitely cutting edge, our other show that we do. And but are you serious? Are you going to do a show about our old summer camp? I mean, a book about Camp Menominee?
Yeah, I would like to.
Wow.
Wow. Now.
I just can't figure out how to do it, but I will figure it out.
Well, I will tell you this. Here's another. This is definitely a story you would have in it. When Marv Levy was inducted into the NFL Hall of Fame, the first two people he thanked were his old high school coach from South Shore High School, Nate Wasserman, the founder of Menominee. And
so, Nate Wasserman was his coach.
It was his coach and his camp director from Camp Interlaken, which was a similar boys camp in Eagle River at the time that my dad went to, Joe Kupcinet, Irv Kupcinet's brother. Those are the first two people.
That's wild.
Marv Levy, the Hall of Fame coach of the Buffalo Bills, thanked. And then,
did you know that Irv Kupcinet was drafted to play quarterback in the NFL?
No.
A shock, because you never think of Irv Kupcinet that way. He was a big star quarterback at Pittsburgh, and he was drafted, I think, by the Steelers. I could have some of the details wrong, but he was drafted very high, and he might have even played a couple of seasons. And back then, you really couldn't make any money, and then he started going into broadcasting. But that's how he was such good friends with Halas, because he was like football friends with Halas.
Our boy, so, Mark Baser, he's kind of like the modern-day Irv Kupcinet in Chicago, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's like,
Irv Kupcinet. He doesn't power lunch as much, but other than that,
he doesn't do it with a four-martini lunch, is what you're saying about Baser? Doesn't smoke the stogies? No, Irv Kupcinet had a talk show on public television in Chicago for decades.
Well, I'll tell you Irv Kupcinet's story, which is when he was old, my father was friends with him. When he was really old, they said, call Cup. Cup's going to put you in his column. He sold the Sun-Times column. And he's going to interview you. This was for Tough Jews. So we talked on the phone. I think it was the phone. He asked me a bunch of questions. And then he said, all right, look on Wednesday in the paper, because you'll be there on Wednesday. So I lived in New York. So on Wednesday, I have to go to, like, now you just go online. But then I had to go to, like, special newsstand. And I got the Sun-Times. Wasn't there. Went there the next Wednesday. Went there for, like, a month. And it wasn't there. So I just gave up. And then, like, 4 years later, somebody's like, hey, you're in the Sun-Times. And I went and got the paper, and I was in Cup's column, and I checked, and sure enough, it was a Wednesday.
He was the worst color analyst in football history. He was paired with Jack Brickhouse on WGN Radio in Chicago. The worst. It was unbelievable how bad he was.
Yeah.
But he had a great career. And
as a columnist and a talk show host, and all around.
His brother, Joe Kupcinet, was the director of Camp Interlaken that Marv Levy went to and was the counselor of my dad. My dad goes on to play football for Marv at Cole College in Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
I mean, that's the thing about Chicago. These people are around. Like, one of the great athletes of all time, right, was Lou Boudreau, who's a Hall of Fame baseball player, played for the Cleveland Indians, was a player coach, I think, with the Cubs, shortstop, you know, first ballot Hall of Fame. His brother was the game warden in our town and used to always give my dog tickets.
What dog's name was that?
That was Laszlo.
That was Laszlo. Great dog name.
And
names.
It was
Muddy
Bruce Boudreau. Yeah, my dad used to say, he used to come in, I go, oh, I'm going to get Laszlo out of this ticket. I'm watching. I'm going to talk to this guy so much. I'm just going to confuse him. He's going to forget why he came. And then he would talk to him for like an hour and a half, and the guy would leave. He wouldn't get the ticket. And he'd be like, see, I told you. He'd be like, yeah, but you just spent an hour and a half of your time to get out of a $5 ticket. Like, you're missing the point.
Lou Boudreau goes on to be the color analyst for the Cubs for years with Lloyd
right.
Pettit and Vince Lloyd, mostly Vince Lloyd. And you obviously knew baseball, but you would have a sense that Lou Boudreau would be like lost. He'd be like a play or two behind. And eventually I interviewed Vince Lloyd for my high school radio station, not WNTH that they had in New Trier, but we had WMTH in Maine East. And I interviewed Vince Lloyd, and then he invited me to the booth at Wrigley Field to sit with him and Lou Boudreau. And I got to find out why Lou Boudreau seemed spaced out a lot of times. Because basically, he wasn't watching the game. He was on the phone at the racetrack, placing bets at Hawthorne right. Racetrack, and just having his binoculars on all the good-looking women at Wrigley Field.
Right.
That was it. That was what Lou Boudreau did at
well,
the booth.
I mean, I think of all the times Harry Carey would have got fired. I mean, I just remember once, like, the camera roaming around to like a woman in a bikini, and Harry be like, holy cow. Fired every time. And also Harry, when Harry Carey was old, when he's at the end, one of the really funny things to do would be to listen to his radio, watch his broadcast and watch the TV. And they would never match because he'd be like, you know, you'd see like a screaming line drive. You're like, oh, no one's getting that. And Harry's like, there's a lazy fly ball. Then the ball would like bounce off the leg, be like, and that's the third out. Everyone's tearing around the base area. He's like, oh, wait a second. He dropped it.
Because
like, if you just been listening.
That's really funny.
I guess he was drunk or whatever, well, but it was hilarious.
Harry would drink on the air while he was doing the game. You always knew when Harry had reached that tipping point because when he was so drunk, he would not be able to pronounce the S's. So
yeah.
It usually happened around the sixth inning. So it would be like this. It would go, after three or after six, the Cardinal two, the Cub one.
No, that's a good imitation.
Thank you very much. I'll
well, I
I'm
like
here all
he
week.
Suddenly,
try the veal.
He would suddenly blurt out a word. He'd be like, Brisgosh. and Steve Stone would be like, what's that, Harry? You go, that's Sandberg spelled backwards. Remember he used to always try to spell everyone's names backwards?
Yeah.
That's his big thing. Also, I had a friend like you who got invited to the booth. And I didn't know he was going to be in the booth. And I was listening. And they go, I'm not going to say his name. But he's like, blah, 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 is up here. And he goes, where is he from? Kenilworth. He goes, hey, how much did your dad pay to get you in here? He just spent like 10 minutes making fun of him. So it turned into probably a dream came true, turned into a nightmare.
Harry
of
Carey,
being mocked on the Cubs broadcast.
We talk about the worst color man in sports history. Harry Carey was partnered for a while with maybe the greatest colorful color man in history, a guy named Jimmy Pearsall, who they did a movie on because he was nuts. And he was a baseball player for the Red Sox, and Harry Carey and Pearsall were paired for the White Sox. I mean, Jimmy Pearsall called the owner's wife, Mary Vec, Bill Vec's wife, that broad, and they just, oh my God, that was so entertaining when
yeah.
Harry Carey and Pearsall were together, Jimmy Pearsall.
Well, I mean, you know, and then, of course they got fired because of stuff that Jimmy Pearsall said about the players' wives being a bunch of horny broads. if I remember correctly, but it was
getting right back to everything's about everything. It's sex, drugs, and rock and roll, whether it be about baseball, the mob, or rock and roll.
Well, also, you know, Harry Carey originally worked for the Cardinals, and he was sort of a regular announcer. If you listen to it, like it's like something happened in his brain, but because he sounds sort of normal. But, you know, this rumor was that he got fired because he had an affair with Anheuser-Busch's wife or whatever.
Augie,
you know?
Augie Bush's wife.
Oh, no,
yeah.
Not, yeah. Yeah. And he has the best non-denial when they asked him. And all he would say is, a young, beautiful gal like that, why would she be interested in me?
and then when they think I learned about this in your book, when they fired him, and he was very popular in St. Louis.
Yeah.
And he had a press conference, and instead of having a Budweiser in his hand, he had a Falstaff, which was one of their competitors. That is
and
classic.
Also, when they drilled down on, did you have an affair with her, all he said was, I've never raped anyone in my life, which seems kind of like a non sequitur.
It sure does. No, I mean, I got fired for asking a perfectly legitimate question about hockey and race. And
well,
and here he was doing his thing. Times have changed in the broadcast world. That's the beautiful thing about the internet. You can pretty much do whatever you want and say whatever you want. That's why I love podcasting so much.
Yeah, but the internet's also the reason why you get fired for no reason. It's both.
It's true. It's two sides of the same coin every time.
You know, it's like everyone's looking to catch you all the time.
Are you allowed to reveal what your next project will be?
I have a big story coming out in the fall in Harper's Magazine about the NFL Combine. I'm pretty proud of that.
Wow.
So I went to the NFL Combine and spent a bunch of days there. And it really interests me because, you know, my son's like really into hockey and travel hockey. And I see the tryouts every year, which are very intense. And it's like the Combine's just the most extreme version of youth hockey tryouts. So I sort of became fast. And that, of course, the Combine is really because of the George Halas, because George Halas really created the draft, because he realized if there wasn't a draft, a couple teams would just dominate the league, and then the league would fold.
Well, that was the old school, man. George Halas, even Nate Wasserman was from the old school, and because Marv was a student, and we used to compete against Interlochen. I mean, Menominee and Interlochen would play the camps. Would have big competitions like we do with Cahuaga now and so many others. But so Marv.
Cahuaga.
Right. So Marv comes over to Menominee. Nate meets him in the parking lot and says, welcome to Menominee, Marv, and just spits a hocker right at Marv's feet.
Right.
I mean, we don't teach the kids that kind of sportsmanship anymore.
No, but what was good about Halas was, on the one hand, you know, the Packers, I think, came in the league the second year. Okay. And on the one hand, you know, the Packers are the rivals right from the beginning. He wanted to beat the crap out of the Packers every time, but he knew that the Packers had to be good. And the Packers had to occasionally beat the Bears. He knew that as the guy who founded the NFL. Because if the games weren't good games and the Packers didn't have a chance to win, the Packers would fold. And the league would fold. So they did things like the revenue sharing, Halas, and the draft, which is kind of against capitalism in a way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it's a socialistic operation. There's no doubt about it, the NFL.
Right, but as soon as you have the draft, then you start to have the need for all kinds of information you didn't have before, intelligence. And out of that comes ultimately, you know, like back in the day, like a guy like Red Grange before the draft, who the Bears wanted to sign, they just invited him to come out to practice, and they practiced with him.
Right.
You know, that was all they had to do.
So when's that article coming out? Right at the start of football season, probably, right?
Well, I think August 28th.
Yeah, all right. Harper's Magazine.
Today, so.
Well, yeah. That's great.
It's funny because I first got involved really in the Cubs. I did a big, long story for Harper's where I traveled around with the Cubs. And Billy Williams, who was a coach on the Cubs end, says, you're not working for a magazine. You made it up. To get free pass. I'm like, I am working for a magazine. No one ever believes me because I'm like, I am working for a magazine. He's like, oh, yeah, what's the name of it? I go, Harper's. He goes, Harper? Harper's the name of a person, not a magazine. And I go, that it's the oldest continually published magazine in America, which it is. Mark Twain wrote for Harper's, you know? And he goes, oh, that's perfect. That's a great detail. Good job. That's why you're smart. Detail like that caused someone to believe it.
Yeah.
They weren't smart like me.
Sweet swinging Billy Williams, number 26.
Yeah.
What guy was he great?
Anyway, I feel good about the Cubs this year.
You do?
I just think they're missing a couple pieces.
Well,
and I think
Kimbrell.
They'll get those pieces.
We got the closer coming. It's got the great beard.
And they need a setup. They need a couple setup people. I mean, just if they had a decent, you know, 6 through 9 inning pitching, they would have 10 more wins. Okay, yeah. So that's what I think. It's because I've watched all these games, and basically, that's always, because I spent, you know, interviewed Theo Epstein and everything for the book. His thing was always that he'd rather pay for the position players and then wait till around the trade deadline and see where they are. And if they have a real chance to make a run, that's when you go for the pitchers. And if you looked at, if you look at a lot of the teams in the major leagues in the last few years who have won, they've gotten key pitchers around the trading deadline. Because I think that's the new model. And the reason is, because the attitude is, you don't want to spend a lot on pitchers for their whole careers because they get hurt. They're hurt so often that you don't want to sink all your money into pitching. And that's what the Mets did.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens as always. And, you know, we'll be watching it together and suffering and enjoying.
Let's make a deal right now. If the Cubs go to the World Series, I'll meet you.
All right.
First game of Wrigley Field.
All right. Done. And
I'm not going to buy any, like a friend of mine bought counterfeit tickets. I'm going to get real tickets.
All right. I will hold you to that as I held you to this.
Okay.
It took 6 months to get you on this podcast.
Hopefully not 6 more months.
And it was worth every moment of it. And, you know, when you're ready to write the book on the other friendly confines of Camp Menominee, let me know.
I even got the title.
What is it?
Hats off to thee.
Nice. A line from one of our songs. Menominee, hats off to thee. To our colors true we shall ever be firm and
strong. Well, I was confused
strong.
When I heard that when I was a kid. I was like, what the hell, are we British? What's this thee crap?
It's to the University of Minnesota fight song.
Okay.
Rah, rah, rah for the green and white. Rah, 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 rah for Menominee. All right. The latest book is The Last Pirate Ship of New York, Rich Cohn. Unbelievable. It was worth all the technical challenges, and enjoy the sun. Wear plenty of sunscreen.
All right, rock on. All right. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you. There he goes.
Bye.
Rich the Rocket Cohn, named after the Rocket Richard from hockey.
What's that?
What's hockey? No, it was, God, I can't forget the guy's first name. It was... Richard, his last name was Richard, and so he got the nickname at camp, Rocket. And he also played hockey when he was a kid. Rich Cohn, he's great. I mean, he's a great guy, but tremendous author. God, is his writing good. The book on the Cubs, this columnist in Chicago opened up his review of Rich books on the Cubs, and the first line was, "Rich Cohn is having a better life than I am." No, he was friends with Mick Jagger and Keith Richards and Martin Scorsese, and he was involved in that HBO show Vinyl about the music industry. Did you ever see that?
No.
Yeah, that was dark. And he had kind of told me about it. We talked on the radio about it. He said, "You know, check out this show Vinyl." I was like, "He's like, I'm involved a little bit." I was like, "All right." So I'm sitting, this is back in the Gingerbread House in Milwaukee. And I'm so on Sunday night, I'm sitting down, here it comes, Vinyl. And, you know, they have all the credits at the beginning. And it says, created by Martin Scorsese, Mick Jagger, and Rich Cohn. And I was like, what the fuck? So the next time I hit him on the radio, I said, why didn't you say something that you were, like, at this level? He said, I don't want to brag about it. You know, just, it's good. Really good.
Cool guy.
It only made one season. They had, very interesting. It was really well done. But it was just dark. There was no humor in it. You've got to have, when you have a dark film like that or a television show like The Sopranos or even The Godfather, there was humor in it. The Deadwood.
Leave the gun.
Yeah.
Take the cannoli.
Yeah. So many things like that. You've got to, because as we've talked about many times, even Viktor Frankl's classic book that outlines his experience at Auschwitz, Man's Search for Meaning, even there was humor. So there wasn't enough. You got to be able to take a breath. And there was so much, you know, talk about drugs and rock and roll, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, Vinyl. Oof. It was definitely worthwhile. It was well done. It just only made it one season, though. Mm. So we continue our season here at Glenn Klein Online. If there is anything that I can do for you life coaching-wise, just go to my coaching site at coachglennklein.com. Highly recommend our show on sexuality and religion called Sex in the Pews as we celebrate sexuality and expose religion. And you can follow Owen on Instagram at Owen in the Pews. And what else?
Don't do drugs. Unless you want to end up like Rich Cohn.
I don't think he probably has done his fair share, I would think. Maybe he's hanging out with the Stones and Willie Nelson. He just said it. Willie's vaping these days.
It was stole that one from Dave Grohl. I saw the Foo Fighters last year. John Travolta was there. Just invited him out on stage out of nowhere. He's like, "And now John Travolta," and he just walked out and waved at everybody in front of 10,000 people and then walked off. He's like, "And that's why you need to stay in school and don't do drugs, or else you'll end up like me, on stage in front of thousands of people, friends hanging out with John Travolta."
Yeah. You know, they always said, you know, if you do drugs, it'll ruin your life. And like every president since Clinton has admitted to smoking marijuana, and you know, we know that Bush did cocaine. You know, Obama was a big partier. Oh no, this president has never done drugs. Maybe that you should do drugs. He's never had a drug or a drink.
Never had a drug or drink.
Yeah.
A stiff, a square.
Yeah.
This guy's a square. He needs a.
What a fascinating guy, Rich Cohn. You are too. He's older than you are, like way older. He's like, you know,
in his 50s, 40s.
He's like probably late 40s, maybe close to 50. We were at camp together, Camp Menominee. Camp Menominee, Northwoods, Wisconsin. Take me home, Keesh and Bus.
Take me home, country roads, to the place I belong.
West Virginia.
Little John Denver for you.
Rocky Mountain. All right, buddy. I love you. We love you people. And we will do it all again next time on Glenn Klein Online. And until that time, this is Glenn Klein.
Owen Rivers.
Saying,
hello, everybody.
Jesus.
Bitches. Oh, that's not this show. Boom. Sex and the Peas.